Pseudopod, episode 154, August 7th, 2009. This week's story, Raising Eddie, by Mark Phelps. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair, and this week's story is Raising Eddie, by Mark Phelps. Whilst this is Eddie's first time out of the gate, or perhaps the grave, Mark has been published before in Revenant, a horror anthology. Your narrator this week is Cayenne Chris Conroy, so without further ado, I suggest you grab a shovel and start digging. Because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Raising Eddie, by Mark Phelps. I never meant to shoot Eddie. That's the first thing you have to understand. Everything that followed was my fault, but I never meant to shoot him. He was my little brother, and he was a pain like all little brothers, but I never meant to shoot him. It happened at the ghost house. We called it the ghost house because we'd both grown up hearing from our dad that one day we were going to move out of the trailer there by the road and down to the creek, once it was finished. I remember seeing that frame of wood through the trees before Eddie was even born, and he was 9 the day we tried to shoot the birds. Dad was gone, like he always was, and Mom was watching her shows. She'd been at the bottle. It was hard for her without Daddy, so she spent most of her time involved in the lives of the rich people on television. I suppose she wasn't the greatest mother ever, but we were boys on summer vacation from school. We had the train tracks, the creek, and the ghost house. We never lacked for stupid things to do. Daddy had picked up another driver's route, trying to make a little more money to get through the year. But we were in Texas, and the route ran from Georgia to Michigan, so even between runs, we didn't see him. By the time things got out of control, we hadn't seen him in over 3 months, and Mom was lost in her shows and the bottle. Daddy started building the ghost house just after I was born. We lived in a trailer just off Garrison Road, but his pappy had left him a stretch of land that went on for a few miles. The ghost house was down by the creek, a good 15-minute walk from the trailer. The land around us was mostly scrub and cactus, but old drooping trees surrounded the banks of the creek. All 13 years of my life, I'd heard Daddy talk about it. How once it was finished, we were going to live by the creek, with our front porch dangling out over the greenish water. We were going to fish from the kitchen table, he always said. But every year meant more roots that took him away for longer stretches. Somehow the money to finish the house never showed up. Mama got sadder and sadder. Me and Eddie got wilder and wilder. The summer was a scorcher. All Texas summers are scorchers, but this one seemed to be going out of its way to suck the moisture out of our bodies. Some days me and Eddie would just lie on the front porch panting like dogs in the heat. That day we were bored, and regardless of the heat, we made plans to go down to the ghost house. We took rifles, of course. You had to know how to shoot out here. Every few evenings we got visitors at night. Raccoons or possums, sometimes even a coyote would come creeping out of the scrub line looking to snatch a cat or a dog. Mama was scared of the animals, and someone had to make sure we were safe. Daddy taught me to shoot out by the creek when I was just 6. Eddie learned about the same time, although he was a lousy shot. Just the same, we took rifles that day, expecting to shoot at the birds that flocked at the eaves of the ghost house. It was near noon when we unlocked the gate leading down to the creek. The sun was high and hot, beating down on us like a whip. We were drenched in sweat before we reached the trail into the trees. The cover provided by all those dangling branches was better than standing directly in the sun, but not by much. Eddie was being good that day. Sometimes he took to whining about the heat and saying he wanted to go watch shows with Mama, but she didn't want any company. She shooed us out of the house if we tried to come in during the day, shouting drunkenly that little boys were meant to play outside. Eddie didn't complain once we made our way past the cactus fields and into the woods, even though he was terribly scared of the ghost house. I don't know what frightened him so much, but knowing what I do now, he was right to be scared. We walked through the woods for a few minutes, following the twisting outline of the creek while Eddie sucked the last sugar out of his bottle of soda. He was trying to lick out the last few drops, tongue jammed into the neck, when the ghost house came into view. It was surrounded by trees, some of which had grown in through the frame itself. Maybe it was just the skeleton of a house, with those limbs poking through it. The way it was half hidden by the trees made it seem like an old place. place with a history. Even though no one had ever lived in it, the ghost house looked less like an unborn house than a dead one. It was two stories and ran from the edge of the creek all the way out to the tree line. It was longer than two trailers set end to end, a big roomy place. There was nothing to it but a frame, and the weather had warped and twisted the boards, turning them gray. Above the second floor, it was all joists, rafters, and that long ridge pole that held it together. That was where the birds flocked. Eddie had the little .22 semi-automatic that we used for shooting rabbit and squirrel, and I had Daddy's .30-06. It was his favorite deer gun, and he would have tanned my hide if he knew I had it. That day wasn't the first time we'd come down to the creek to shoot. We didn't do it all the time because sometimes the guns cracked so loud that our neighbor across the creek, Mr. Davenport, would hear and call up Mama. Most times we shot on the bank of the creek, setting up dirty beer bottles, leftovers from teenage parties. It was our land and we kept a fence, but fence never did mean much to a kid of any age. When we got to the ghost house, Eddie didn't want to go any further. He didn't start fussing, but he started dragging his feet, covering his kids with dust. I wasn't in the mood to fight with him, so I just kept walking. Faced with being alone in the woods or with his big brother at the ghost house, Eddie came on along. I wonder sometimes if he knew something. If he had some sort of feeling about what was going to happen. It's the kind of thing that can drive you crazy. If you let it. The house frame was filled with birds. Mostly rock doves that built their nests up in the rafters, but also a few crows who flapped noisily down to steal food from the doves. We stood out by the imaginary front porch, our backs to the rolling creek. Me and Eddie had been down here before, mostly throwing rocks at the birds. The guns were a new idea. Eddie still wasn't interested in going in, so I left him there on the bank, after a bit of teasing. Like I said, Eddie was a good little brother. He could be a pain, but that wasn't his fault. He followed me around all the time, but I couldn't say I honestly minded. There were only three or four kids my age in the area. None of them particularly wanted to be friends with us. Our daddy didn't belong to the local Masonic lodge, and our mama didn't participate much in whatever it was the women did. It wasn't that anyone disliked us in particular. It was just that we were the family who lived in a shitty old trailer up on the hill. The whole town was poor, but at least they had finished houses. I realized what a stupid idea the whole thing had been when I got up on the second floor. It wasn't hard to climb up, even with the rifle slung over my shoulder. There was no sheetrock, just line after line of 2x4. It was like swinging on a jungle gym. I jumped up and grabbed a beam in the first floor ceiling, pulled myself up and balanced on it. I did the same thing again, and I was up. I could still see Eddie standing on the creek's edge, his little .22 slung around his back. He was watching me climb with that odd look he got when I did something he wasn't old enough to manage. "Come on up!" I shouted. Eddie looked at me, and then at the house, before shaking his head. "Well, don't go shooting that thing while I'm up here." I didn't stop to see if he was paying attention, because just about that time, the biggest crow I'd ever seen came swooping out of the trees and landed on the ridgepole of the attic. A fury of doves exploded out of the house, leaving their little nests behind. They'd come back once the big crow had his fill, but I had better plans. There wasn't much room to stand up there. There was no floor on the second level, but my feet weren't big, and I was comfortable walking the struts. I pulled Daddy's .30-06 off my shoulder and reached into my pocket for some bullets. I popped in three rounds as quietly as I could. That big crow glared at me like I was a nuisance, so I got myself in position. If it was stupid enough to stay put after I loaded the rifle, it deserved what was coming to it. Getting myself in position involved pushing my back up against a board and making sure my feet were firmly planted. The .30-06 kicked like a bastard. I'd shot deer with it before and wondered what it would do to a bird. I glanced down at Eddie before I lined up my shot. His eyes were open wide, jumping between me and the crow. I raised the rifle to my shoulder and stared down the sights at the crow who was busy digging through a dove nest for something to eat. I did like my daddy taught me. I breathed deeply a few times, keeping my sight on the crow, and then after a breath, I squeezed, not pulled, the trigger. The shot flew wild. The few birds left scattered into the sky, fleeing the thunderous crack of the gun. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Eddie jump, but that crow, he stayed put. He turned his black head and fixed an eye on me.
as if to say no shit-ass kid with his daddy's gun was going to scare him off. I was breathing heavy, but I wasn't scared. The sound of the gun, the knot on my shoulder where it had driven me into the frame, the look in that crow's eye. None of them was going to stop me from a second shot. I was so pumped up that I jerked the lever on the rifle, popping out the smoking shell, and drove it home again to load another. The shell rattled on the ground below, but I didn't have time to look and see. I raised the rifle again and curled my finger along the trigger. I had the crow in my sights again when he shot into the air and came straight at me. One second he was picking through a nest, and the next he was a black missile fired into my face. I jerked back, trying to keep him lined up, thinking about the story I'd be able to tell if I managed to shoot him on the wing. I put my foot out to steady myself, but there was nothing there. I stepped off the board and fell. The sticky air swallowed me as I fell, and I saw the crow light exactly where I'd been standing. Then the ground slapped me. I heard thunder roll across the creek, but I couldn't breathe. I lay on the ground, pain shooting through my body, gasping, trying to suck in the hot air. It took me a while, but when I finally got my breath back, I checked on Eddie. I was worried about him, worried that he would have been scared by the fall. He wasn't there. I was still reeling from the fall, and I barely noticed the last wisps of smoke curling from the barrel. I rushed out of the ghost house to the edge of the creek. I looked up and down at figuring that Eddie had fallen in. Less than 20 feet from me, I saw his body, floating in the lazy green current, hung up on an old branch. I knew then that he was dead. It didn't take much. A dead thing and a live thing just looked different. Every kid in the country knows that. He was floating face down, and a pale stream of blood spooled off him, following the current of the creek. Even as I jumped into the water to save him, I knew it was too late. There was a hole the size of a fist in his back, bloody and raw. Swimming back to the shore, I hooked my arm around his neck, pulling Eddie with me. I pushed him out first, rolling his little body onto the gravel. Blood and green water dribbled out of his mouth. As I pulled myself out, I could see his dead, flat eyes.
If you've never killed anyone, it might be hard to understand how fast your brain can work. In that moment, I saw my future fall apart like a badly made house. I saw myself in prison, down to Huntsville, maybe, for the rest of my life. I saw my daddy weeping over his beer, and my mama, eyes wild and unfocused, scratching at the dirt of Eddie's grave. Mostly I saw those dead eyes, staring at me for the rest of my life, accusing me.
I'd like to say I rushed Eddie back home, or ran back and called an ambulance, but I can't.
I sat there stroking Eddie's wet hair and staring at that hole in a daze. I walked over to the rifle and confirmed what I already knew. The thunder I heard when I fell hadn't been in my head. There was one bullet left, and I stood there for a time thinking about using it. I couldn't go back and tell Mama what happened. It would kill her. She was barely hanging on with the misery of being poor, the sorrow of having a missing husband. She'd never be able to cope with a son dead at the other's hand. But I didn't want to die, and I couldn't accept that Eddie was gone for good. He was right there, on the ground. He was the same as he'd always been. Except for that hole. Standing there with the rifle, I thought about Vera Walsh for the first time. I wish now that her name had never popped into my head. Sometimes, I wish that I had used that final bullet. It would have been easier than what followed. Vera Walsh was an old woman who lived by herself. She never came into town, and every kid knew that she was a witch. Sure, our parents would tell us there was no such thing, but we had all heard about the men that made their way out there looking for a little something to get their pecker stiff, and the women who needed to get rid of something. We played tricks on most people, at one time or another, but there was no kid in the valley brave enough to play tricks on Vera Walsh. It wasn't even something we kidded about. Everyone in town had at least one story about Vera, about what she could do, or what she had done. I left Eddie there. I felt bad leaving his body lying on the ground all alone, but I couldn't carry him all the way.
I thought that Vera Wash might be able to help me, but I knew that if help was coming, it had to come fast. So I dropped the rifle and I started running. I've never run so fast as I did that day. Up from the creek, past the fields of cactus, past the road and over the train tracks. Vera lived up by herself on top of Kinderley Hill. Town rumors said she owned all that land, although there were 100 different stories on how she'd gotten it. They ranged anywhere from a dead husband to a pact with the devil. As I ran, I hoped it was the devil. I needed someone who could do things like that, who could change what happened by the creek. I had to get Eddie back. It was the only thing I could think to do, the only path that didn't destroy everything I loved. I stopped running when I reached her house. It was a little four-room affair perched at the top of the hill, its gray paint sloughing off like snakeskin. It had a tin roof rusted and punched through with holes. The holes were stuffed with rags. It was midsummer in Texas, but there was smoke rising from the tall pipe that ran the height of the house. I don't know how I managed to get on the front porch, but once there, I couldn't go any further. I'd had so little time to think since I fell, since I shot Eddie. I stood at the door, my hand hanging in the air, too afraid to knock. When the door opened and I saw Vera Wash, I wanted to scream and run, but I couldn't. She held me there, wriggling like a worm in the hook of her eye. Vera Wash was an old woman. She was 80 if she was a day, and time hadn't been kind to her. Her skin was jowly like a hound, and she wore an old cotton dress of blue calico. Her stockings were rolled down around her ankles, and she was carrying a can of Pabst in one withered hand. But it was her eye that held me. Her left eye was cloudy, like someone had sprayed glue over it, but you could see the pupil behind the white, and it bounced around like the eyes of a doll you'd win at the fair, pointing this way and that, never resting on anything for long. Her right eye was still good, and it felt like she was reading me like a book with that eye.
"What you want?"
Her voice was harsh and grating. She sounded busy, but not upset. I couldn't speak. All I could do was stare into that big brown eye and tremble.
"Speak up, boy! You interrupted me at work. You need summon? Or you just here to get the evil eye?"
With this lash, she raised one finger and pulled down the lid on her milky eye. I threw up a hand to shield myself. I didn't know what it would do, but I didn't want either of those eyes on me. I know I couldn't tell her about Eddie, but I had to do something. Finally, I blurted out, It's my dog!"
"Your dog? What about him?"
"He's dead, ma'am. And
you thought I could do something about it, did you?"
I looked down. I couldn't hold her eye and lie at the same time. Staring at the curving boards of the porch, I said, "Yes, ma'am. I heard around town that you could help with stuff like that. Maybe a potion of some sort?" She took a swig from the can and held it against her forehead, pushing aside the wispy white hair that curled there. Her arms were flabby with extra skin, and they wobbled as she cooled her brow.
"Raising the dead is serious business, boy. It don't generally come cheap, and it ain't easy. You love that dog."
I started crying then. Well, maybe it was earlier. It's hard to know.
"Yes, ma'am."
I managed to choke out.
"His name. What's his name?"
My mind spun. I didn't have a dog. Daddy wouldn't let us get one because Mama screamed and shouted when we had asked. He was never there, and Daddy said it wasn't fair to saddle Mama with a pet when all she wanted was her husband. Me and Eddie had begged and promised to take care of it, but Daddy had given Mama what he could.
"Eddie."
It was out of my mouth before I could take it back. Vera Wash never came into town anymore, but surely she knew the name of my brother. If she did, it didn't cause her a moment of thought. She handed me her beer and said,
"Stay here, boy."
The door closed behind her as she walked back into the house. As soon as her old screen door slapped shut, I wanted to run. I was in over my head and I was terrified. But I kept seeing Mama's face as she screamed next to Eddie's headstone, so I stayed put. I also wanted a swig of that Pabst.
It was hot, and I'd been running without a sip of water. But the idea of putting my lips on that can where her lips had been made me feel cold even in the merciless heat. I could see through the screen door into her hallway. Both sides of the hall were stuffed with books. I expected them to be books full of dark spells, but from the few covers I could see, they looked just like Mama's romance stories. There were men and women on them, holding each other tight. Past the books, the hall led into her kitchen, and I could see a pot hanging from a hook above the fire. It bubbled and smoked, and I was afraid to know what was in it. I was staring at it when she came back, making me jump and spill a little of the beer. She'd come back through a side door, catching me as I checked out her house.
"Snoopy little bastard, ain't you?"
She opened the screen door and grabbed the beer out of my hand. She replaced it with a brown rock. It looked like one of a million rocks I'd skipped across the creek, flat, worn smooth, with a little flecks of something shiny in the grain. I held it in my hand, and I must have looked at it for a long time.
"You better get that to your dog. He's strong, but if you leave him laying dead too long, his spirit can't find his way back."
"What do I do with it?"
"Stuff it in his mouth. The stone does the rest."
I looked from the stone to her milky eye, afraid to ask the next question. It had to be asked, though, if I were going to get Eddie back.
What do I owe you?"
She laughed, and I felt a trickle of pee squirt out of me. Not enough to wet my pants, but it was close.
"Just this time, we'll call it even. Take my advice, boy, and throw that stone away. I don't want nothing from you, but if you use that thing, there's a price to be paid."
"A price? To who?"
"Never you mind. Get yourself a new dog and bury the old. If you can't bring yourself to do that, then remember what I said."
I ran then, clutching the stone tightly in my fist. As my sneakers pounded the dusty ground, I kept hearing her voice saying, "There's a price to be paid." In the end, it was as easy as she said it would be. I got back to the creek, and after I dunked my head in and sipped a little of the nasty-tasting water, I sat down in front of Eddie. He was still laying there, eyes staring up into the sun, as if he'd find Daddy there. That same surprised look on his face. If I was going to do it, I had to do it quick. That's what Vera Walsh had told me. But she'd also told me not to do it. To just get myself another dog. Of course, Eddie was no dog. And there would be no burying him in the backfield. There was nowhere to get another just like him. Was Eddie alive, or my life in ruins? It wasn't much of a choice. His jaw had locked up, and I couldn't get the stone in his mouth. I tried shoving it in through the little gap he had in front. He'd knocked out both front teeth playing Superman. One mistimed jump onto the bed, and he'd caught the railing, swallowing both his front teeth before I could figure out what had happened. I couldn't fit the stone through the gap. It ground against his other teeth like a mortar against pestle. I struggled for a good 15 minutes trying to get his mouth open. I pulled at his face and even stuck a twig in behind his back teeth trying to pry his mouth open. I cut up his cheeks and gums, but I finally managed to pry his mouth wide enough that I could force the stone in. I wedged it between his gaping teeth and drove it in using the palm of my hand. There was a loud click, and the stone filled the cavity of his mouth. I don't know what I expected. For him to leap up off the ground, I guess. For him to roll over and tell me he'd just been kidding. For this day to have never happened. Any of those would have been fine. Instead, he just lay there, warming in the sun like spoiled food. I waited for more than 3 hours, watching the sun make its way to the horizon. I sat about 15 feet away from Eddie, afraid to be any closer. I couldn't tell you what I thought about while I waited. I'm not sure I thought at all. There was some more crying, and a mess of staring at Eddie and the rifle. But other than that, it was one long blank. When he moved, I screamed. It was loud enough to scare off the birds. Maybe loud enough that Mama would have heard if she'd been listening for us. We stayed out late most nights and made our own supper when we got hungry. No one was going to come looking for us. At first, it was just his hand moving. It wiggled back and forth like he was playing with a yo-yo. Then his legs started to shake like those fellas you see on TV when they're being electrocuted. They shimmied and shook until I thought Eddie was going to roll into the water. I stood up and moved closer.
When I got up beside him, those eyes that had been staring at the sun, they swiveled and turned to me. I jumped back. Eddie rolled over, pushing himself off the ground with his skinny arms, and then he vomited. The stone came first, but it was followed by a mess of blood so dark and congealed it looked like tar. He sicked it all up, staining the gravel, and then he turned to me. Maybe he was trying to say my name. Maybe he was mad because I shot him. I don't know. What came out of his mouth wasn't human. Once when Daddy was home, he had taken us both out rabbit hunting. Daddy was an amazing shot. He could stand in the back of his pickup and shoot out a rabbit's eye while it raced across the field. I wasn't so good a shot, and once I managed to hit one without killing it. It had screamed as we ran into the field, and that scream sounded like Eddie did now. Something in terrible pain, but without enough brain to say so. I held my ears while he screamed. I wanted to look away, but I couldn't. He was just sitting there, screaming his head off, as that black blood dribbled down his chin. After a while, he stopped and just stared at me. He didn't say another word all night. He never said another word again. At least nothing that sounded like my little brother. It was getting late, so I washed him off as best I could with water from the creek. His shirt was ruined, so I pulled it off and tossed it in the bushes. When I did, I found the hole in his little chest, the one I'd put there, was gone. There was a dark purple bruise, but no hole. I took him home, making sure Mama was passed out before sneaking him in. I put him in bed, and I was happy when he closed his eyes. With his eyes closed, tangled up in his Hulk sheets, he looked just the way he was supposed to. I sat there for an hour, just stroking his dirty hair before I went to bed myself. I thought it was a dream at first. A nightmare, really. That scream had been bouncing around in my head since Eddie had woken up. Since Eddie had come back from wherever he had been. So I thought it was just more of the same. Until I smelled the smoke. When I got my eyes opened, they stung. Our room was filled with smoke, and it only took me seconds to get moving. I kept low the way they taught us at school, but it didn't seem to help. Every breath I took burned my lungs. I checked Eddie's bed, and he wasn't in it. Staring at the empty bed, I just kept hearing that old woman talking about a price to be paid. I tried to find Mama, so help me, I did. But the fire was already out of control, and she must have come to in the night and moved from her place on the couch back to her bedroom. The hall leading to her room was filled with flames. I thought about running into them, letting the fire take me. We'd be together then, me and Mama. But Eddie was still out there somewhere, and he was my little brother. I left Mama in the house. I knew when I did that she wasn't going to make it out. The whole place was going up fast and spilling noxious smoke from the burned-up plastic. I barely made it out the door, rolling down the steps, picking up half a dozen stickers in my back. Eddie was standing in the moonlight, swaying back and forth like one of the flames. He was drooling, his eyes locked on the fire that was burning everything we knew. He had a torch in his hand. He'd made it from one of the chair legs in a t-shirt. I don't know where he got the gasoline, maybe out of Mama's car, maybe the lawnmower. When I got my breath back a little, I tackled him. It was like hitting a sack of groceries. He didn't fight back, didn't resist. He crumpled to the ground like a scarecrow, letting the torch roll out of his hand where it set the grass on fire. I left him on the ground and ran over to stamp out the torch. I rubbed it in the dirt until the flame went out, and then raced around the yard, stamping on little fires. While I saved the yard, the trailer burned like a fireworks display. Holding the torch, I looked back at Eddie. He was lying in the dirt like a rag doll, his drool turning the ground into mud. Whatever energy he'd used to set the fire was gone now. I would have thought him dead if his tiny chest hadn't been heaving up and down. I held him there, cradling his head in my hands, stroking his hair until I heard the sirens. Soon there would be firemen and police, and everyone wanting to know what had happened. As the sirens came closer, I lifted Eddie, slinging him over my back. It was a long walk,
but I could make it if I had to. I never lost the sound of the sirens, even as I made my way to the creek, Eddie over one shoulder and the torch in my hand. I could still hear them when we reached the ghost house. Eddie started kicking up a fuss the closer we got to it. By the time we reached the front porch, I had to drag him. He was wiggling around, trying to slow me down, but he couldn't manage much of a fight. I left him there in the gravel and found Daddy's old shed. It was locked, but the lock was old and rusty. It didn't stand up to the rock I slammed against it. The shed was full of tools. They were the tools Daddy had used to put up the frame, the tools that we had meant to use to build our house by the creek. I pulled out a few lengths of rope and the hammer. Tying Eddie to the frame wasn't hard. He tried to fight me, but he was too weak. Whatever had given him the strength to burn us out had fled. He flailed against me, squealing like an animal. But I heard the sirens and kept going. I trussed him up in the back where our room was to have been. When I was done, I laid the torch down on the gravel, hoping there was still enough gasoline in the dirty shirt to catch. I drove the hammer against the stones until sparks flew and the torch caught fire. I picked it up off the ground and walked into the ghost house. Eddie could see it flaming in my hand, my nostrils filled with the smells of Eddie's rotting body and gas. Just before I touched the torch to the old frame, Eddie's eyes seemed to focus, seemed to find me for the first time. It caught immediately, racing across the ghost house, lighting up the sky. The birds leapt from their homes, filling the world with feathers and the rustling of wings. I stood at the edge of the creek, watching it burn, wishing that the price hadn't been so high. I saw the stone still covered in Eddie's black blood. I picked it up. They found me not too much later. The fire had drawn their attention. By then, their voices sounded like the rush of fires in my ears. Even when they found Eddie, he shook me like an animal. I couldn't quite put together what they were saying. They didn't understand. It was my fault. The guns, Eddie's death, the stone, the fires, all my fault. He was my brother, and I loved him. I couldn't let him stay that way. They had to pry the stone out of my hand.
I think about mistakes a lot, partially because I'm Catholic and Catholicism is a religion which is particularly fascinated by your mistakes, and partially because I sometimes find it very difficult to not feel I make too many of them. It's one of the perils of being a big guy, of being built like a door. There's often a tiny hint, and sometimes actually fairly big hint, of bull in the china shop to how I move through spaces, and whilst I've got much, much better at it, it's always there. As a result, I often feel a little clumsy, a little awkward, and sometimes I break things, much less than I used to, but it does happen. The weird thing is, I'm okay with it. Not because I didn't particularly like those glasses, but because it's a mistake, and a mistake is a flag you plant so you can see where you're going, or perhaps where you shouldn't go again. The old Edison quote about how we now know 1,000 ways not to build a light bulb springs to mind. You're defined as much by the doors that close, or don't open, or sometimes fall out of their frames onto your head in the most embarrassing manner possible, as you are by the ones that do, and that's something that's taken me a very long time to figure out. Mistakes are good. Not in the immediate scheme of things. In the immediate scheme of things, they're rubbish. But in the long term, because they teach you what not to do, as much as what to do. Plus, being imperfect is so much more fun. After all, who would you want to be? Han? Or Luke? Of course, Luke would never Jedi mind trick you out of your money. We rely on you to pay our authors, so if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you, each and every cent goes to covering our costs, and each and every cent is incredibly gratefully appreciated. Also, why not check out escapepod.org for the best in science fiction, beamed to you directly from a satellite that, okay, may have been the JLA's headquarters once, but which we won, fair and square, and Aquaman should shut up. Or, why not visit The Podcastle, floating serenely over the intertubes at podcastle.org for the best in fantasy. Pseudopod, and in fact the other two, is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Our closing music is by Hopeful Machines, who are a side project of Ego Likeness, and you can find out more about both of them at egolikeness.com. Please join us next week for a bloody tale of unusual crime and even more unusual punishment in The Worm That Gnaws by Orin Gray. In the meantime, if Pseudopod is going to do this, you're going to get us some pie.